This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents What Makes You Not a Buddhist? Written by Zongsar Jamyong Kensei. Performed by Tom Pyle.
Introduction. Once, I was seated on a plane in the middle seat of the middle row on a transatlantic flight, and the sympathetic man sitting next to me made an attempt to be friendly. Seeing my shaved head and maroon skirt, he gathered that I was a Buddhist. When the meal was served, the man considerately offered to order a vegetarian meal for me. Having correctly assumed that I was a Buddhist, he also assumed that I don't eat meat. That was the beginning of our chat. The flight was long, so to kill our boredom, we discussed Buddhism. Over time, I've come to realize that people often associate Buddhism and Buddhists with peace, meditation, and nonviolence. In fact, many seem to think that saffron or maroon robes and a peaceful smile are all it takes to be a Buddhist. As a fanatical Buddhist myself, I must take pride in this reputation, particularly the nonviolent aspect of it, which is so rare in this age of war and violence, and especially religious violence. Throughout the history of humankind, religion seems to beget brutality. Even today, religious extremist violence dominates the news. Yet I think I can say with confidence that so far we Buddhists have not disgraced ourselves. Violence has never played a part in propagating Buddhism. However, as a trained Buddhist, I also feel a little discontented when Buddhism is associated with nothing beyond vegetarianism, nonviolence, peace, and meditation. Prince Siddhartha, who sacrificed all the comforts and luxuries of palace life, must have been searching for more than passivity and shrubbery when he set out to discover enlightenment. Although essentially very simple, Buddhism cannot be easily explained. It is almost inconceivably complex, vast, and deep. Although it is non-religious and non-theistic, it's difficult to present Buddhism without sounding theoretical and religious. As Buddhism traveled to different parts of the world, the cultural characteristics it accumulated have made it even more complicated to decipher. Theistic trappings, such as incense, bells, and multicolored hats, can attract people's attention, but at the same time, they can be obstacles. People end up thinking that is all there is to Buddhism and are diverted from its essence. Sometimes out of frustration that Siddhartha's teachings have not caught on enough for my liking, and sometimes out of my own ambition, I entertain ideas of reforming Buddhism, making it easier, more straightforward and puritanical. It is devious and misguided to imagine, as I sometimes do, simplifying Buddhism into defined, calculated practices like meditating three times a day, adhering to certain dress codes, and holding certain ideological beliefs, such as that the whole world must be converted to Buddhism. If we could promise that such practices would provide immediate, tangible results, I think there would be more Buddhists in the world. But when I recover from these fantasies, which I rarely do, my sober mind warns me that a world of people calling themselves Buddhists would not necessarily be a better world. Many people mistakenly think that Buddha is the god of Buddhism. Even some people in commonly recognized Buddhist countries such as Korea, Japan, and Bhutan have this theistic approach to Buddha and Buddhism. That is why, throughout this audiobook, we use the name Siddhartha and Buddha interchangeably, to remind people that Buddha was just a man, and that this man became Buddha. It's understandable that some people might think that Buddhists are followers of this external man named Buddha. However, Buddha himself pointed out that we should not venerate a person, but rather the wisdom that person teaches. Similarly, it's taken for granted that reincarnation and karma are the most essential beliefs of Buddhism. There are numerous other gross misconceptions. For example, Tibetan Buddhism is sometimes referred to as Lamaism, and Zen is not even considered Buddhism in some cases. Those people who are slightly more informed, yet still misguided, may use words such as emptiness and nirvana without understanding their meaning. When a conversation arises like the one with my seatmate on the plane, a non-Buddhist may casually ask, "What makes someone a Buddhist?" That is the hardest question to answer. If the person has a genuine interest, the complete answer does not make for light dinner conversation, and generalizations can lead to misunderstanding. Suppose that you give them the true answer, the answer that points to the very foundation of this 2,500-year-old tradition. One is a Buddhist if he or she accepts the following four truths. All compounded things are impermanent. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. Nirvana is beyond concepts. These four statements, spoken by the Buddha himself, are known as the four seals. Traditionally, seal means something like a hallmark that confirms authenticity. For the sake of simplicity and flow, we will refer to these statements herein as both seals and truths, not to be confused with Buddhism's four noble truths, which pertain solely to aspects of suffering. Even though the four seals are believed to encompass all of Buddhism, people don't seem to want to hear about them. Without further explanation, they serve only to dampen spirits and fail to inspire further interest in many cases. The topic of conversation changes, and that's the end of it. The message of the four seals is meant to be understood literally, not metaphorically or mystically, and meant to be taken seriously. But the seals are not edicts or commandments. With a little contemplation, one sees that there is nothing moralistic or ritualistic about them. There is no mention of good or bad behavior. They are secular truths based on wisdom, and wisdom is the primary concern of a Buddhist. Morals and ethics are secondary. A few puffs of a cigarette and a little fooling around don't prevent someone from becoming a Buddhist. That is not to say that we have license to be wicked or immoral. Broadly speaking, wisdom comes from a mind that has what the Buddhists call right view. But one doesn't have to consider oneself a Buddhist to have right view. Ultimately, it is this view that determines our motivation and action. It is the view that guides us on the path of Buddhism. If we can adopt wholesome behaviors in addition to the four seals, it makes us even better Buddhists. But what makes you not a Buddhist? If you cannot accept that all compounded or fabricated things are impermanent, if you believe that there is some essential substance or concept that is permanent, then you are not a Buddhist. If you cannot accept that all emotions are pain, if you believe that actually some emotions are purely pleasurable, then you are not a Buddhist. If you cannot accept that all phenomena are illusory and empty, if you believe that certain things do exist inherently, then you are not a Buddhist. And if you think that enlightenment exists within the spheres of time, space, and power, then you are not a Buddhist. So, what makes you a Buddhist? You may not have been born in a Buddhist country or to a Buddhist family. You may not wear robes or shave your head. You may eat meat and idolize Eminem and Paris Hilton. That does not mean you cannot be a Buddhist. In order to be a Buddhist, you must accept that all compounded phenomena are impermanent, all emotions are pain, all things have no inherent existence, and enlightenment is beyond concepts. It's not necessary to be constantly and endlessly mindful of these four truths, but they must reside in your mind. You don't walk around persistently remembering your own name, but when someone asks you your name, you remember it instantly. There's no doubt. Anyone who accepts these four seals, even independently of Buddhist teachings, even never having heard the name Shakyamuni Buddha, can be considered to be on the same path as he. When I tried to explain all of this to the man next to me on the plane, I began to hear a soft snoring sound and realized that he was sound asleep. Apparently, our conversation did not kill his boredom. I enjoy generalizing, and as you listen to this audiobook, you will find a sea of generalizations. But I justify this to myself by thinking that, apart from generalizations, we human beings don't have much means of communication. That's a generalization in itself. By creating this audiobook, it is not my aim to persuade people to follow Shakyamuni Buddha, become Buddhists, and practice the Dharma. I deliberately do not mention any meditation techniques, practices, or mantras. My primary intention is to point out the unique part of Buddhism that differentiates it from other views. What did this Indian prince say that earned so much respect and admiration, even from skeptical modern scientists like Albert Einstein? What did he say that moved thousands of pilgrims to prostrate themselves all the way from Tibet to Bodh Gaya? What sets Buddhism apart from the religions of the world? I believe it boils down to the four seals, and I have attempted to present these difficult concepts in the simplest language available to me. Siddhartha's priority was to get down to the root of the problem. Buddhism is not culturally bound. Its benefits are not limited to any particular society and have no place in government and politics. Siddhartha was not interested in academic treatises and scientifically provable theories. Whether the world is flat or round did not concern him. He had a different kind of practicality. He wanted to get to the bottom of suffering. I hope to illustrate that his ideas are not a grandiose intellectual philosophy to be read and then shelved, but a functional, logical view that can be practiced by each and every individual. To that end, I have attempted to use examples from all aspects of all walks of life, from the romantic crush to the emergence of civilization as we know it. While these examples are different from the ones Siddhartha used, the same message Siddhartha expressed is still relevant today. But Siddhartha also said that his words should not be taken for granted without analysis. So, definitely, someone as ordinary as myself must also be scrutinized, and I invite you to analyze what you hear within these chapters. Chapter 1. Fabrication and Impermanence. Buddha was not a celestial being. He was a simple human. But not too simple, for he was a prince. He went by the name Siddhartha Gautama, and he enjoyed a privileged life. A beautiful palace in Kapilavastu, a loving wife and son, adoring parents, loyal subjects, lush gardens with peacocks, and a host of well-endowed courtesans. His father, Suddhodana, made sure that his every need was taken care of and his every wish fulfilled within the palace walls. For when Siddhartha was a baby, an astrologer had predicted that the prince might choose to become a hermit in his later life, and Suddhodana was determined that Siddhartha would succeed him as king. Siddhartha never quarreled with his family. In fact, he cared for them and loved them very much. He had easy relations with everyone, apart from occasional tension with one of his cousins. As Siddhartha grew older, he became curious about his country and the world beyond. Bending to his son's pleas, the king agreed to let the prince venture beyond the palace walls on an excursion, but he gave strict instructions to the chariot driver, Channa, that the prince should be exposed only to things beautiful and wholesome. Indeed, Siddhartha very much enjoyed the mountains and the rivers and all the natural wealth of this earth. But on the way home, the two came upon a peasant who was groaning by the roadside, racked with pain from some excruciating illness. All his life, Siddhartha had been surrounded by strapping bodyguards and healthy ladies at the court. The sound of groans and the sight of a diseased, racked body were shocking to him. Witnessing the vulnerability of the human body impressed him deeply, and he returned to the palace with a heavy heart. As time passed, the prince seemingly returned to normal, but he longed to make another journey. Again, Suddhodana reluctantly agreed. This time, Siddhartha saw a toothless old crone hobbling along, and he immediately ordered Chana to stop. He asked his driver, "Why is this person walking so?" "She's old, my lord," said Chana. "What is old?" asked Siddhartha. "The elements of her body have been used and worn out over a long time," said Chana. Shaken by this spectacle, Siddhartha let Chana drive him home. Now Siddhartha's curiosity could not be abated. What else was out there? So off he and Chana went on a third journey. Again he enjoyed the beauty of the region, the mountains and the streams. But as they were returning home, they came upon four pallbearers carrying a flat, lifeless body on a palanquin. Siddhartha had never in his life seen such a thing. Chana explained that the frail body was actually dead. Siddhartha asked, "Will death come to others?" Chana answered, "Yes, my lord, it will come to all." "To my father? Even to my son?" "Yes, to everyone. Whether you are rich or poor, high caste or low, you cannot escape death. It is the fate of all who are born on this earth." Upon first hearing the story of the dawn of Siddhartha's realization, we might think that he was remarkably unsophisticated. It seems rather strange to hear of a prince, raised to lead an entire kingdom, asking such simplistic questions. But we are the ones who are naive. In this information age, we are surrounded by images of decay and death, beheadings, bullfights, bloody murder. Far from reminding us of our own fate, these images are used for entertainment and profit. Death has become a consumer product. Most of us do not contemplate the nature of death on a deep level. We don't acknowledge that our bodies and environment are made up of unstable elements that can fall apart with even the slightest provocation. Of course, we know that one day we will die. But most of us, unless we've been diagnosed with a terminal illness, think that we are in the clear for the time being. On the rare occasion that we think about death, we wonder, "How much will I inherit?" or "Where will they scatter my ashes?" In that sense, we are unsophisticated. After his third journey, Siddhartha became genuinely despondent over his powerlessness to protect his subjects, his parents, and most of all his beloved wife, Yashodhara, and son, Rahula, from unavoidable death. He had the means to prevent such miseries as poverty, hunger, and homelessness, but he could not shield them from old age and death. As he became consumed with these thoughts, Siddhartha attempted to discuss mortality with his father. The king was understandably puzzled that the prince was so caught up with what he regarded as a theoretical dilemma. Suddhodana was also increasingly worried that his son would fulfill the prophecy and choose the path of asceticism instead of taking his place as the rightful heir to the kingdom. In those days, it was not unheard of for privileged and wealthy Hindus to become ascetics. Suddhodana outwardly tried to dismiss Siddhartha's fixation, but he had not forgotten the prophecy. This was not a passing melancholic reflection. Siddhartha was obsessed. To prevent the prince from sinking deeper into his depression, Suddhodana told him not to leave the palace again and secretly instructed the royal attendants to keep close watch on his son. In the meantime, like any concerned father, he did everything he could to make things right by concealing further evidence of death and decay from the prince's view. Baby rattles and other distractions. In many ways, we are all like Suddhodana. In our everyday lives, we have this impulse to shield ourselves and others from the truth. We've become impervious to obvious signs of decay. We encourage ourselves by not dwelling on it and by employing positive affirmations. We celebrate our birthdays by blowing out candles, ignoring the fact that the extinguished candles could equally be seen as a reminder that we are a year closer to death. We celebrate the new year with firecrackers and champagne, distracting ourselves from the fact that the old year will never come back and the new year is filled with uncertainty. Anything can happen. When that anything is displeasing, We deliberately divert our attention, like a mother distracting a child with rattles and toys. If we feel down, we go shopping, we treat ourselves, we go to the cinema. We build fantasies and aim for lifetime achievements. Beach houses, plaques and trophies, early retirement, nice cars, good friends and family, fame, making it into the Guinness Book of World Records. Later in life, we want a devoted companion with whom we can take a cruise or raise purebred poodles. Magazines and television introduce and reinforce such models of happiness and success, ever inventing new illusions to trap us. The notions of success are our grown-up baby rattles. Hardly anything we do in the course of a day, neither in our thoughts nor in our actions, indicates that we are aware of how fragile life is. We spend our time doing things like waiting at the multiplex for a bad movie to start, or rushing home to watch reality TV. And as we sit watching commercials, waiting, our time in this life ebbs away. A rare glimpse of old age and death was enough to instill in Siddhartha a longing to be exposed to the truth in its entirety. After his third journey, he tried several times to leave the palace on his own, but always in vain. Then, one remarkable night, after the usual evening of feasting and revelry, a mysterious spell swept through the court, overpowering all but Siddhartha. He wandered the halls and found that everyone, from King Suddhodana to the lowliest servants, had fallen into a deep sleep. Buddhists believed that this collective somnolence was due to the collective merit of all humans, because it was the inciting event that led to the creation of a great being. Without the need to please the royals, the slack-jawed courtesans snored, their limbs akimbo, their jeweled fingers dropped in their curries. Like crushed flowers, they had lost their beauty. Siddhartha did not rush to make order, as we might have done. This sight only strengthened his determination. The loss of their beauty was just more evidence of impermanence. As they slumbered, the prince was finally able to take his leave unobserved. With one last look at Yashodhara and Rahula, he crept out into the night. In many ways, we are like Siddhartha. We may not be princes with peacocks, but we do have careers and house cats and countless responsibilities. We have our own palaces, one-room apartments in the slums, split levels in the suburbs, or penthouses in Paris, and our own Yashodharas and Rahulas. And things go awry all the time. Appliances break, the neighbors argue, the roof leaks, our loved ones die, or maybe they just look like death in the morning before they wake up, their jaws as slack as those of Siddhartha's courtesans. Maybe they smell like stale cigarettes or last night's garlic sauce. They nag us, and they chew with their mouths open. Yet we are stuck there willingly. We don't try to escape. Or if we do get fed up and think enough is enough, we may leave a relationship, only to start all over again with another person. We never grow weary of this cycle because we have hope and belief that the perfect soulmate or a flawless Shangri-La is out there waiting for us. When faced with daily irritations, our reflex is to think that we can make it right. This is all fixable. Teeth are brushable. We can feel whole. Maybe we also think that someday we will have gained perfect maturity from the lessons of our lives. We expect to be wise old sages like Yoda, not realizing that maturity is just another aspect of decay. Subconsciously, we are lured by the expectation that we will reach a stage where we don't have to fix anything ever again. One day we will reach happily ever after. We are convinced of the notion of resolution. It's as if everything that we've experienced up until now, our whole lives to this moment, was a dress rehearsal. We believe that our grand performance is yet to come, so we do not live for today. For most people, this endless managing, rearranging, upgrading is the definition of living. In reality, we are waiting for life to start. When prodded, most of us admit that we are working towards some future moment of perfection, retirement in a log cabin in Kennebunkport or in a hut in Costa Rica. Or maybe the dream of living out our later years in the idealized forest landscape of a Chinese painting, serenely meditating in a tea house overlooking a waterfall in Koi Pond. We also have a tendency to think that after we die, the world will go on. The same sun will shine, and the same planets will rotate just as we think they have done since time began. Our children will inherit the earth. This shows how ignorant we are of the persistent shifting of this world and all phenomena. Children don't always outlive parents, and while they are alive, they don't necessarily conform to our ideal. Your sweet little well-behaved kids can grow up into cocaine-snorting thugs who bring home all kinds of lovers. The straightest parents in the world produce some of the most flamboyant homosexuals, just as some of the most laid-back hippies end up with neoconservative children. Yet, we still cling to the archetype of the family and the dream of having our bloodlines, jawlines, surnames, and traditions carried on through our progeny. Seeking the truth can seem like a bad thing. It's important to recognize that the prince was not abandoning his domestic responsibilities. He wasn't evading the draft to join an organic farming community or to follow a romantic dream. He was leaving home with the determination of a husband sacrificing comfort in order to earn necessary and valuable provisions for his family, even if they did not see it so. We can only imagine Suddhodana's grief and disappointment the next morning. It was the same disappointment of modern parents who discovered that their teenagers have run off to Kathmandu or Ibiza to chase some idealistic vision of utopia, like the flower children of the 60s, many of whom also came from comfortable, prosperous homes. Instead of donning bell-bottoms, piercings, purple hair dye, and tattoos, Siddhartha rebelled by removing his princely finery, discarding these items that identified him as an educated aristocrat. He clothed himself in only a scrap of cloth and became a wandering mendicant. Our society, so accustomed to judging people by what they have rather than who they are, would expect Siddhartha to stay in the palace, lead the privileged life, and carry on his family's name. The model of success in our world is Bill Gates. Rarely do we think in terms of the success of Gandhi. In certain Asian societies, as well as in the West, parents pressure their children to succeed in school far beyond what could be considered healthy. The children need good marks in order to be accepted to Ivy League schools, and they need Ivy League degrees to get high-ranking jobs at the bank, and all this is just so that the family can perpetuate its eternal dynasty. Imagine that your son suddenly gives up his illustrious and lucrative career after becoming aware of death and old age. He no longer sees the point of working 14-hour days, sucking up to his boss, greedily swallowing up competitors, destroying the environment, contributing to child labor, and living in constant tension, only to have a few weeks of vacation every year. He tells you that he wants to cash in his stocks, donate everything to an orphanage, and become a vagabond. What would you do? Give him your blessing and boast to your friends about how your son has come to his senses at last? Or would you tell him that he's being utterly irresponsible and send him to a psychiatrist? Mere aversion to death and old age was not reason enough for the prince to turn his back on his palace life and step into the unknown. Siddhartha was drawn to take such drastic action because he could not rationalize the fact that this was the fate of all beings that had ever been born and ever would be born. If everything that is born must decay and die, then all the peacocks in the garden, the jewels, canopies, incense and music, the golden tray that held his slippers, the imported carafes, his bond with Yashodhara and Rahula, his family, and his country, were all meaningless. What was the purpose of all this? Why would any person of sound mind shed blood and tears for something that he knew would eventually evaporate or must be abandoned? How could he remain in the artificial bliss of his palace? We may wonder where Siddhartha could go. Inside or outside the palace, there's no place to take refuge from death. All his royal wealth couldn't buy him an extension. Was he on a quest for immortality? We know that's futile. We are entertained by the fantastic myths of the immortal Greek gods and the stories of the Holy Grail with its elixir of immortality and Ponce de Leon leading the conquistadores on a fruitless search for the Fountain of Youth. We chuckle at the legendary Chinese emperor Qin Shi Huang, who sent a delegation of virgin boys and girls to far-off lands to seek out potions that would confer long life. We might think that Siddhartha was after the same thing. It's true that he left the palace with some naivete. He would not be able to make his wife and child live forever, but his search was not futile. What Buddha found. Without a single scientific tool, Prince Siddhartha sat on a patch of kusha grass beneath a ficus religiosa tree, investigating human nature. After a long time of contemplation, he came to the realization that all form, including our flesh and bones, and all of our emotions and all our perceptions, are assembled. They are the product of two or more things coming together. When any two components or more come together, a new phenomenon emerges. Nails and wood become a table, water and leaves become tea, fear, devotion, and a savior become God. This end product doesn't have an existence independent of its parts. Believing it truly exists independently is the greatest deception. Meanwhile, the parts have undergone a change. Just by meeting, their character has changed, and together they have become something else. They are compounded. He realized that this applies not only to the human experience, but to all matter, the entire world, the universe, because everything is interdependent. Everything is subject to change. Not one component in all creation exists in an autonomous, permanent, pure state. Not the device in which you are listening to this audiobook, not atoms, not even the gods. So as long as something exists within reach of our mind, even in our imagination, such as a man with four arms, then it depends on the existence of something else. Thus, Siddhartha discovered that impermanence does not mean death as we usually think, it means change. Anything that changes in relation to another thing, even the slightest shift, is subject to the laws of impermanence. Through these realizations, Siddhartha found a way around the suffering of mortality after all. He accepted that change is inevitable and that death is just a part of this cycle. Furthermore, he realized that there was no almighty power who could reverse the path to death. Therefore, there was also no hope to trap him. If there's no blind hope, there's also no disappointment. If one knows that everything is impermanent, one does not grasp. And if one does not grasp, one will not think in terms of having or lacking, and therefore one lives fully. Siddhartha's awakening from the illusion of permanence gives us reason to refer to him as the Buddha, the awakened one. Now, 2,500 years later, we see that what he discovered and taught is a priceless treasure that has inspired millions, educated and illiterate, rich and poor, from King Ashoka to Allen Ginsberg, from Kublai Khan to Gandhi, from H.H. the Dalai Lama to the Beastie Boys. On the other hand, if Siddhartha were here today, he would be more than a little disappointed because, for the most part, his discoveries lie fallow. That is not to say that modern technology is so great that his findings have been refuted. No one has become immortal. Everyone must die at some point. An estimated 250,000 human beings do so every day. People close to us have died and will die. Yet we are still shocked and saddened when a loved one passes away. and we continue to search for the fountain of youth or a secret formula for long life. Trips to the health food store, our bottles of DMAE and retinol, power yoga classes, Korean ginseng, plastic surgery, collagen injections, and moisturizing lotion. These are clear evidence that we secretly share Emperor Qin's desire for immortality. Prince Siddhartha no longer needed or wanted the elixir of immortality. By realizing that all things are assembled, that deconstruction is infinite, and that not one of the components in all creation exists in an autonomous, permanent, pure state, he was liberated. Anything that is put together, which we now understand to be everything, and its impermanent nature are bound together as one, just like water and an ice cube. When we put an ice cube in our drink, we get both. Just so, when Siddhartha looked at someone walking around, even the healthiest person, he saw this person as both simultaneously living and disintegrating. You might think this doesn't sound like a fun way to live, but it can be an amazing ride to see both sides. There might be great satisfaction. It's not like a roller coaster of hope and disappointment going up and down. Seeing things in this way, they begin to dissolve all around us. Your perception of phenomena transforms and in a way becomes clearer. It's so easy to see how people get caught up in the roller coaster, and you naturally have compassion for them. One of the reasons you have compassion is that impermanence is so obvious, yet they just don't see it. For now-ness. By nature, the act of assembly is bound by time, a beginning, a middle, and an end. This audiobook did not exist before. It appears to exist now, and eventually it will fall apart. Similarly, the self that existed yesterday, that is, you, is different from the self that exists today. Your bad mood has become good. You may have learned something. You have new memories. The scrape on your knee has healed a little. Our seemingly continuous existence is a series of beginnings and endings bound by time. Even the very act of creation requires time, a time before existing, a time of coming into existence, and an end to the act of creation. Those who believe in an almighty God generally do not analyze their concept of time because God is assumed to be independent of time. To give credit to an all-powerful, omnipotent creator, we must factor in the element of time. If this world has always existed, there would be no need for creation. Therefore, it must not have existed for a period of time before creation, and thus a sequence of time is required. Since the Creator, let's say God, necessarily abides by the laws of time, he, too, must be subject to change, even if the only change he has ever gone through has been creating this one world. And that's fine. An omnipresent and permanent God cannot change. So it's better to have an impermanent God who can answer prayers and change the weather. But as long as God's actions are an assemblage of beginnings and ends, he's impermanent. In other words, subject to uncertainty and unreliable. If there is no paper, there is no book. If there is no water, there's no ice. If there is no beginning, there is no end. The existence of one very much depends on the other. Therefore, there is no such thing as true independence. Because of interdependence, if one component, the leg of a table, for example, makes even a small shift, then the integrity of the whole is compromised, unstable. Although we think we can control change, most of the time it's not possible because of the countless unseen influences of which we are unaware. And because of this interdependence, the disintegration of all things in their current or original state is inevitable. Every change contains within it an element of death. Today is the death of yesterday. Most people accept that everything born must eventually die. However, our definitions of everything and death may differ. For Siddhartha, birth refers to all creation, not just flowers and mushrooms and human beings, but everything that is born or assembled in any way. And death refers to any kind of disintegration or disassembly. Siddhartha had no research grants or assistance, just the hot Indian dust and a few passing water buffalo as witnesses. So equipped, he realized the truth of impermanence on a profound level. His realization was not as spectacular as finding a new star. It was not designed to propound moral judgments or to establish a social movement or religion, nor was it a prophecy. Impermanence is a simple, mundane fact. It's highly unlikely that one of these days some mischievous compounded thing will become permanent. Even less likely would be our ability to prove such a thing. Yet today, we either deify Buddha or try to outsmart Buddha with our advanced technology. And yet we still ignore it. 2,538 years after Siddhartha walked out the palace door, at the time of year when many millions of people are celebrating, making merry, and anticipating a fresh start, the time to remember God for some, the time to take advantage of discount sales for others, a catastrophic tsunami shook the world. Even the most cold-hearted of us gasped in horror. As the story unfolded on television, some of us wished that Orson Welles would interrupt to announce that it was all a fabrication, or that Spider-Man would sweep down to save the day. There's no doubt that Prince Siddhartha's heart would have broken to see the tsunami victims washed ashore. But his heart would have been more broken by the fact that we were taken by surprise, proof of our constant denial of impermanence. This planet is made of volatile magma. Every landmass, Australia, Taiwan, the Americas, is like dew about to drop from the grass. Yet construction of skyscrapers and tunnels never stops. Our insatiable deforestation for the sake of disposable chopsticks and junk mail only invites impermanence to act more quickly. It should not surprise us to see signs of the end of any given phenomenon, but we are very difficult to convince. Yet even after a devastating reminder like the tsunami, the death and devastation will soon be camouflaged and forgotten. Luxurious resorts will be erected on the very spot where families came to identify the corpses of their loved ones. The people of the world will continue to be caught up in compounding and fabricating reality with hopes of achieving long-lasting happiness. Wishing for happily ever after is nothing more than a desire for permanence in disguise. Fabricating concepts such as eternal love, everlasting happiness, and salvation generates more evidence of impermanence. Our intention and the results are at odds. We intend to establish ourselves and our world, but we forget that the corrosion begins as soon as creation begins. What we aim for is not decay, but what we do leads directly to decay. At the very least, Buddha advised, we must try to keep the concept of impermanence in mind and not knowingly conceal it. By maintaining our awareness of assembled phenomena, we become aware of interdependence. Recognizing interdependence, we recognize impermanence. And when we remember that things are impermanent, we are less likely to be enslaved by assumptions, rigid beliefs, both religious and secular, value systems, or blind faith. Such awareness prevents us from getting caught up in all kinds of personal, political, and relationship dramas. We begin to know that things are not entirely under our control and never will be, so there is no expectation for things to go according to our hopes and fears. There is no one to blame when things go wrong, because there are countless causes and conditions to blame. We can direct this awareness from the farthest regions of our imaginations to subatomic levels. Even atoms cannot be trusted. Instability. This planet, Earth, you are sitting on right now as you listen to this audiobook, will eventually become as lifeless as Mars, if it's not shattered by a meteor first. Or a supervolcano might obscure the sun's light, extinguishing all life on Earth. Many of the stars that we romantically gaze at in the night sky are already long gone. We are enjoying the rays from stars that expired a million light years ago. On the surface of this fragile Earth, the continents are still shifting. 300 million years ago, the American continents that we now know were part of a single supercontinent that geologists call Pangaea. But we don't have to wait 300 million years to see change. Even within one short lifespan, we have witnessed the grandiose concept of empires fade away like a water spot on hot sand. For example, India used to have an empress who lived in England and whose flag waved in countries around the globe. But today, the sun does set on the Union Jack. The so-called nationalities and races with which we so strongly identify are ever-changing. For example, warriors such as the Maori and Navajo, who once ruled their territories for hundreds of years, now live as minorities on cramped reservations, while immigrants who have settled from Europe in the last 250 years are the ruling majorities. Han Chinese used to refer to the Manchu people as them, but China has since decided it is a republic comprising many ethnic groups, so now the Manchu are us. However, this constant transformation hasn't stopped us from sacrificing life and limb to establish powerful nations, borders, and societies. How much blood has been shed in the name of political systems over the centuries? Each system is shaped by and assembled from innumerable unstable factors. The economy, harvests, personal ambition, the cardiovascular condition of a leader, lust, love, and luck. Legendary leaders are also unstable. Some fall from grace because they smoke but don't inhale. Others come into power because of hanging chads. The complexity of impermanence and the instability of all compounded phenomena only increases within the realm of international relations, because the definitions of ally and enemy are constantly shifting. There was a time when America blindly lashed out at an enemy called communism. Even Che Guevara, a great social hero, was condemned as a terrorist because he belonged to a certain party and wore a red star in his beret. He may very well not even have been the perfect communist we painted him to be. A few decades later, the White House now woos China, the largest single communist country, granting her most favored nation status and turning a blind eye to the very things that used to merit an American battle cry. It must be because of the volatile nature of foes and friends that when China begged to attend Siddhartha on his quest for the truth, Siddhartha refused. Even his closest confidant and friend was subject to change. We often experience changing alliances in personal relationships. The best friend with whom you have shared your deepest secrets has the power to become your worst enemy, because he or she can turn that intimacy against you. President Bush, Osama bin Laden, and Saddam Hussein had a big, messy public breakup. The trio had long enjoyed a cozy relationship, but now they have become the very model of archenemies. Using their intimate knowledge of one another, they have commenced a bloody crusade, costing many thousands of lives in order to enforce their different versions of morality. Because we are proud of our principles and often impose them on others, this concept of morality still holds a wisp of value. However, the definition of morality has changed throughout human history, shifting according to the zeitgeist of that era. America's ever-fluctuating barometer of what is politically correct or incorrect is mind-boggling. No matter how one refers to the various races or cultural groups, someone is bound to get offended. The rules keep changing. One day, We invite a friend to dinner, and since he's a fanatical vegetarian, we have to tailor the menu to him. But then the next time he comes over, he asks, "Where's the meat?" Because now he's a fanatical protein diet practitioner. Or someone who advocates abstinence before marriage can suddenly become very promiscuous once he or she tries it once. Ancient Asian art depicts women walking bare-breasted. And even in recent history, some Asian societies found it acceptable for women to go without a top. Then, the assembled phenomena of television and Western values ushered in a new ethic. Suddenly, it's morally wrong to go braless. Even if you don't cover your breasts, you're considered vulgar and can even be arrested. Once free-spirited countries now busy themselves adopting this and other new ethics, ordering bras, and covering up as much as possible during even the hottest monsoon. The breast isn't inherently bad. The breast hasn't changed, but the morals have. The change transforms the breast into something sinful, leading the U.S. Federal Communications Commission to fine CBS $550,000 for Janet Jackson's 3-second exposure of just one of her mammaries. Causes and conditions. The egg is cooked, and there's nothing you can do about it. When Siddhartha spoke of all assembled things, he was referring to more than just obvious perceptible phenomena such as DNA, your dog, the Eiffel Tower, eggs, and sperm. Mind, time, memory, and God are also assembled. And each assembled component in turn depends on several layers of assembly. Similarly, when he taught impermanence, he went beyond conventional thinking about the end, such as the notion that death happens once and then it's over. Death is continuous from the moment of birth, from the moment of creation. Each change is a form of death, and therefore each birth contains the death of something else. Consider cooking a hen's egg. Without constant change, the cooking of an egg cannot occur. The cooked egg result requires some fundamental causes and conditions. Obviously, you need an egg, a pot of water, and some sort of heating element. And then there are some not-so-essential causes and conditions, such as a kitchen, lights, an egg timer, a hand to put the egg into the pot. Another important condition is absence of interruption, such as a power outage or a goat walking in and overturning the pot. Furthermore, each condition, the hen, for example, requires another set of causes and conditions. It needs another hen to lay an egg so that it can be born, a safe place for this to happen, and food to help it grow. The chicken feed has to be grown somewhere and must make its way to the chicken. We can keep breaking down the indispensable and dispensable requirements all the way to the subatomic level, with an ever-increasing number of forms, shapes, functions, and labels. When all the innumerable causes and conditions come together, and there's no obstacle or interruption, the result is inevitable. Many understand this to be fate or luck, but we still do have the power to have an effect on conditions, at least in the beginning. But at a certain point, even if we pray that the egg won't cook, it will be cooked. Like the egg, all phenomena are the product of myriad components, and therefore they are variable. Nearly all of these myriad components are beyond our control, and for that reason, they defy our expectations. The least promising presidential candidate might win the election and then lead the country to contentment and prosperity. The candidate you campaign for might win and then lead the country to economic and social ruin, making your life miserable. You may think liberal, left-wing politics are enlightened politics, but they may actually be the cause of fascism and skinheads by being complacent or even promoting tolerance of the intolerant, or by protecting the individual rights of those whose sole purpose is to destroy other people's individual rights. This same unpredictability applies to all forms, feelings, perceptions, traditions, love, trust, mistrust, skepticism, even the relationships between spiritual masters and disciples, and between men and their gods. All of these phenomena are impermanent. Take skepticism, for example. There was once a Canadian man who was the very embodiment of a skeptic. He enjoyed attending Buddhist teachings so that he could argue with the teachers. He was actually quite well versed in Buddhist philosophy, so his arguments were strong. He relished the opportunity to quote the Buddhist teaching that the Buddha's words must be analyzed and not taken for granted. A few years later, and he is now the devoted follower of a famous psychic channeler. The ultimate skeptic sits before his singing guru with tears running like rivers from his eyes, devoted to an entity who has not a scrap of logic to offer. Faith or devotion has a general connotation of being unwavering, but like skepticism and like all compounded phenomena, is impermanent. Whether you pride yourself on your religion or on not belonging to any religion, faith plays an important role in your existence. Even not believing requires faith. Total blind faith in your own logic or reason based on your ever-changing feelings. So it's no surprise that what used to seem so convincing no longer persuades us. The illogical nature of faith is not subtle at all. In fact, it is among the most assembled and interdependent of phenomena. Faith can be triggered by the right look at the right time in the right place. Your faith may depend on superficial compatibility. Let's say that you're a misogynist and you meet a person who is preaching hatred against women. You will find that person powerful. You will agree with him, and you will have some faith in him. Something as inconsequential as a shared love of anchovies might add to your devotion. Or perhaps a person or institution has the ability to lessen your fear of the unknown. Other factors, such as the family, country, or society you are born into, are all part of the assembly of elements that come together as what we call faith. Citizens of many Buddhist-ruled countries, such as Bhutan, Korea, Japan, and Thailand, are blindly committed to the Buddhist doctrine. On the other hand, many young people in those countries become disillusioned with Buddhism because there is not enough information and too many distractions for the phenomena of faith to stick, and they end up following another faith or following their own reason. Impermanence works for us. There are many benefits to understanding the notion of assembly, how creating even one boiled egg involves such a vast number of phenomena. When we learn to see the assembled parts of all things and situations, we learn to cultivate forgiveness, understanding, open-mindedness, and fearlessness. For example, some people still single out Mark Chapman as the sole culprit in John Lennon's murder. Perhaps if our celebrity worship were not so great, Mark Chapman would not have created the fan.